Welcome to Tonic Boom, a specialist capital markets podcast series brought to you by Tonic, the expertise-led consultancy dedicated to giving firms more. Join our host, our resident Tonic ninjas and industry experts as we drop the mic on the hot market topics across high-profile domains such as margin, post-trade, treasury, risk, digital, legal, sustainability, and more. More expertise, more trust, more achieved. Ready for your dose of Tonic?
Welcome to the latest edition of Tonic Boom. I'm Craig Pearson, co-founder of Tonic, and will be your host for this episode, where we're going to discuss the shift towards non-cash collateral for variation margin. I'm joined by Mark Higgins, Bank of New York's product manager leading the BNY margin segregation business, and Alan Baxter, an industry SME in XVA and capital markets. In this episode, we'll unpack what's driving the renewed interest in non-cash VM, why real-world volumes still lag the sentiment, and how Triparty has the potential to solve some of the challenges and make securities as VM scalable in practice. We'll close with what needs to change for adoption to accelerate, and with an eye on a future where tokenization could eventually strengthen collateral mobility over the long term. But before we get into that, as is boom tradition, we'll start with our icebreaker of two truths and one lie. This week, we'll be putting Alan under the spotlight. And there's a bit of pressure on myself because I think Tonic are in the lead with the detection of those lies to date. So Alan, I'll hand to you.
Thanks, Craig. In terms of two truths and one lie, I have a MIT-developed eye following an operation a couple of years ago. I've played twice at the Real Madrid training ground and 13 pitch, and I once beat Ed Miliband in parkrun in Vancouver.
Oh, that's some good ones. I might lean on my fellow podcaster, Mark. You know Alan a little better than me. Any of those ring true?
The first two.
I think, straight in.
I think it's the Ed Miliband is the lie.
That's a strange one to
make
up.
I know he's a football player.
Yeah.
Or has been. So, yeah, I think it's the first two.
Okay. So it's a very niche lie to make up.
Mark's got it spot on. Ed Miliband beat me in the Vancouver
park.
By two places.
Did you go for a bacon sandwich with him afterwards?
We did have a chat afterwards, but we were two tourists in Vancouver, so it was very benign chat.
Very good. Okay. Well, let's move on. Although I doubt it'll be as interesting as that. What are we going to cover today? So the uncleared margin rules were intended to shift the risk management of OTC positions towards the cleared model, including the standardization of acceptable collateral. Variation margin quickly became a cash-only utility, both in response to the standardization of the terms, but also as a consequence of firms simplifying their operational approach to accelerate that compliance readiness. In today's rate and liquidity environment, the form of VM is quickly becoming a strategic decision again. Higher rates have made cash-only VM more expensive, and that funding conversation is now front and center for both buy-side and sell-side. Liquidity management has become more dynamic. Firms want to preserve cash and mobilize securities where possible, especially around stress events and quarter ends. Although the latest ISDA survey showed growth in non-cash collateral, cash remains the predominant asset for variation margin. Historic barriers to greater adoption include the operational complexity and the availability of data. However, many firms can no longer ignore the benefit of optimized asset utilization, and we are seeing a trend to revisit that strategic operating model to address these challenges. Ultimately, optionality and collateral type is increasingly valuable to firms on both sides. I'll start with yourself, Alan. In simple terms, what are the top business drivers behind clients pushing for non-cash variation margin?
I think from the buy side, it's a liquidity driver. And from the sell side, there's potentially a revenue, but they are going to be very cognizant of the incremental cost and resource utilization, in particular with the net stable funding ratio.
Okay. So I hear firms talking about RWA, NSFR, as you've just mentioned, and the liquidity capital ratio. But what does that actually mean in practice for the way DES are modelling the economics and the end-to-end metrics?
Okay, so if one takes a look at a buy-side firm looking to add corporate bonds to a CSA, the implications for the DES are going to be a combination of PV. So it will change the way the DES discounts that portfolio. In the scenarios where it actually receives the corporate bonds, this will mean that there is an incremental net stable funding ratio requirement. Now, These are mitigatable. Well, the net stable funding is mitigatable. And this can be done through reposting of these assets where you are freeing up better quality collateral, such as government bonds, also known as level one assets. However, the PV component of the discounting is difficult to hedge, and it's something that banks will be concerned about.
Excellent. So what do you see as the strongest business case for non-cash variation margin, and why?
Banks should be offering their clients liquidity, and they should be charging their clients for that liquidity. And I think we've seen the market starting to change recently, and banks are willing to have those conversations. They are concerned, as mentioned earlier, about the incremental capital requirements. But the client's requirements following some of the market events that we saw in 2022 have meant that clients are now waking up to the fact that they need this optionality in their portfolios to manage their own liquidity events.
Very good. The million-dollar question, or rather multi-million-dollar question in some use cases, which I appreciate will differ for individual firms and depend on multiple factors, so nobody's going to hold you to account on this, but can you help quantify the size of the opportunity to give listeners some context? What are the scale of benefits that you've seen either delivered or hypothetical based on some of your recent analysis?
So I definitely agree it's going to be different per bank. However, banks that offer long-dated derivatives to the pension fund community could be talking millions of dollars per annum in revenues from offering this liquidity. From a sell side perspective, I think it's difficult to quantify because this is a stress scenario that they are looking to cover. However, having the optionality can save them significant amount of money of entering the repo market at times of high stress to source cash or government bonds, or prevent the sale of gilt at a time of market impairment.
Okay, that's good news for the banks if we're talking multi-million per annum savings, because the return on investment, although, albeit the change may be significant, that return on investment could be realized within the first 12 months.
Yeah, probably within the first 12 months. I mean, there are some incremental costs for banks that they would need to take on, in particular around the NSFR.
Yeah.
But as mentioned earlier, this can be mitigated if you can reuse those assets elsewhere in your collateral ladders. But it's definitely an opportunity to make that investment and reap those returns on an annualized basis.
So considering the size of returns we're talking about, why are we seeing sentiment shift faster than behavior? Are desks convinced on economics but blocked elsewhere?
I think each bank has different constraints. Some of those constraints are going to be from a capital perspective. So a bank that is NSFR constrained will be more reluctant to do this than others. Other banks might be concerned about the lack of ability to hedge the coal VA, as it is known or otherwise known as discounting risk. Some banks may be concerned about their reuse cases, such as in the repo. So there may be preparatory work going on in the modification of schedules, etc., to get people in a position to go live with this. Also, operationally, it can be difficult to reutilize these assets. And I think that is one of the questions they will be asking their operations teams.
Yeah, and that's a good segue to bring Mark into the conversation. So Mark, what have you seen that explains the gap between the buy-side ambition and the sell-side pace?
So I've been doing research on this over the last, 12 months, 18 months. And I've spoken to buy side, sell side, tech providers, the whole range. I think it's interesting that the buy side have been largely out there asking the sell side, I'd like to do this. And to some degree, the door was closed. It was not interested. I think I've seen that change over the last 6 months. And now I've definitely recognized that the sell side is starting to gear up for this. I think that the barriers to entry on this, though, it's largely held within the banking organizations. Many of them have said to me that they got ready and connected and geared up around the initial margin for securities, but they really need to play catch up now on VM.
I mean, the operational complexity you reference is certainly a challenge, something we've seen firsthand at Tonic. To succeed in implementing this requires the participation of multiple business areas and may even impact the P&L of individual teams that they're measured against. So despite delivering enterprise-wide benefits, there can be a conflict in motivation. The change will also often be competing with other initiatives of prioritization. And so a robust business case that demonstrates those returns you spoke about earlier, Alan, is even more vital. In your experience, who are the roles within the organizations that need to sponsor this initiative?
Different organizations have different setups, but broadly speaking, we're talking the XVA desk, the repo desk, and the financial resource optimization teams. It may also come from Treasury ALM, who are managing that collateral. but it's going to be a front office sponsorship.
And Mark, is that consistent with who you're seeing talking to you about this at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, when I started out on this, I thought, I come from an ops background and I spoke to ops people and thought it was an ops thing. And then very quickly started to pivot towards it isn't. Ops is about the execution. They'll be delivering what they're asked to execute on. This is about saving money or making money. And therefore, it does go to the front office, as Alan's just said.
And operationally, where do you see firms getting stuck first? So let's say they've got the impetus and the mandate to get this over the line. What are the challenges they face?
So in the sales side, look, this is not brand new. The ability to handle non-cash assets as variation margin is back to the arc, right? It never went away. So they've always had that capability. They have to gear up on scale. This is about a larger book. It may well be that they're going to, through necessity, have to handle equities potentially. Certainly corporate bonds gets discussed a lot. Whereas historically, it might have been pivotal around government securities. So that's on the sell side. On the buy side, there is a potential leap. Again, many in the buy side, they have had non-cash capability written into the CSAs for years. Whether they execute it or not is another matter. What I have seen in my research of talking to the software providers that are market leaders in collateral management workflow tools, half a dozen of them at least have said, we've all geared up on the tech over the last year, and most of those systems are sold into the buy side. So the buy side are clearly asking for new capability. I want better pricing. I want optimization, the ability to select and track the workflow. These are all things that have gone into that technology conversation to try and put them on par with the often in-house built capabilities of the sell side.
And when we talk about operational complications, one point we hear a lot is the ability to recall and receive back collateral.
Mm.
Do recent regulations such as CSDR make it even more challenging and firms more reluctant, considering the regulatory penalties if they can't get it back in time?
Inevitably. I mean, if you perform a recall and it's for whatever reason, you know, let's say the bank can't get it back quick enough, you can have commercial implications in terms of not sourcing the asset to onward sell and failing and to meet your commercial opportunity. But in addition to that, as you say, you could potentially be hit with a settlement fine. And that's passed back to the bank if they've caused it. But you know, that is a wrinkle that firms would want to consider when they're moving from cash into non-cash.
And Alan, what other challenges beyond operation do you see, particularly documentation, CSA constraints, internal policy?
Internal policy would be where one would start. So one would need to have conversations with the credit officers and risk managers that you are comfortable taking on board these assets from both a credit perspective, but also a liquidity perspective. Operationally, we would need to be comfortable that we will receive these assets in a timely manner. I think also when looking at how we can mitigate and ring fence some of these assets, it is possible to do siloed CSAs, whereby you enter into trades under a cash govies corporate CSA and a equal and offsetting trade in a cash and govies CSA. So this effectively allows the client to execute a stochastic repo that in certain market scenarios will give them the ability to post corporate bonds and receive govies from the bank. Now, we would need to make sure operationally this can be done and that bank systems can cope with multiple CSAs within a netting set. So there may be some additional work to be done there.
Are there any data challenges that you see?
I think the broader the CSA, the more work one needs to do in monitoring eligibility criteria. But fundamentally, these assets are already posted and on the bank's balance sheet. So it is something that banks should be able to cope with minimal effort.
Yeah, I can pick up on that one, Alan. So I looked at a client a couple of years ago that was outsourcing collateral management to us as a middle office function. And they had some, what some call dirty CSAs, where there were complex non-cash assets written into the agreement. The reality was that we or the counterparties actually couldn't adapt the modeling to practice. So I think that this is something that we have to be aware of, particularly old pre-2017 agreements. Some of them are written with complexity that operationally can't be delivered. So this is something to be aware of, Craig, as we see others entering the market. I think that if you're going to go in and you're going to go for new non-cash CSAs, please talk to your operations people about, can you actually deploy the rules that we're putting in here? The concentration limits come up a lot. That was one of the things that the tech companies were saying they were having to build in the oversight of the security. It can be a lot more complex than it used to be a few years ago, where you had a simple collateral ladder, a grid in a power 11 or 13 of your CSA, and it was ABC at rating of 1, 2, 3. It's got more akin to what we see in the tri-party world, which was born for a complex repo or stock loan market.
And so if that business case is there, what has to change within some of these organizations to make this operable? Is it people, process, tech, or a combination?
It's all of it. It's all of it.
And I think there needs to be a risk appetite to the amount of discounting risk you are willing to take to these assets.
So clients want to move from cash only to cash and securities practice. What are the operational changes that they underestimate? And Mark, I think we've spoken in the past about how Tri-Party can potentially solve for some of this. So I'll hand the floor to yourself.
So again, go back to what I was saying there about technology. It's imperative that you've got the right tech in place. A good collateral management software is imperative. Go back years when I worked in a software firm, we used to find that was the natural sell of the collateral management system was that we wanted to do cash and non-cash. Why? Because you need to track the securities, manage the settlement, get the pricing right, look at the concentration limits. Cash is cash. It's the most simple thing. And people do still manage cash CSAs on spreadsheets. We know that.
Yeah.
So I think if you have the right background system-wise, you're in a good position. The impact, though, when you move to securities cascades into settlement. So we mentioned before about the substitution process, and that's a known bind, but also just simply settling them out and back, not even a substitution, but just getting them to your counterparty and back again can prove problematic. This is an evolutionary process. We're going back to how I remember growing up as a collateral manager in the 90s, which is cash and non-cash were very common. And it's coming back in trend. And with that will be an increase in volume. And with more volume and more complexity will be more fails and more oversight and more risk and concern. So I think it's imperative that they get the right tech, they get the right policy. Now we talk about Tri-Party. Tri-Party is a well-known proven platform for segregating initial margin. In fact, the take up of this has been fantastic. We've seen our own clients moving away from our third party margin direct offering into the Tri-Party because it's just more efficient.
Yeah.
And it also opens the door to accepting equities, corporate bonds above the usual traditional government securities. So Tri-Party becomes a natural evolutionary platform step for many clients, whether they're buy side or an expansion for the sell side. If we're going to go to Tri-Party, I think that Tri-Party is key for the buy side in terms of settlement efficiency. You know, we used to sell this as an optimization tool, and it still is. But optimization to a bank broker dealer with billions of securities and thousands of line items is a different conversation than to a buy side who has 100 securities and wants to ensure that they will go from their account to the counterparty's account and back again. And that's actually come out in conversation quite a lot when I've spoken to the buy side, particularly with insurance companies who I've focused a lot of attention on. They are looking to allocate a lot of corporates. Corporates can be a bit more tricky in terms of bilateral settlement, more so than govies. And they have a wider spread of assets in their portfolio. So it's a basket-based delivery, which is Tri-Party's speciality, makes a lot more sense than perhaps, say, institution that's got five US treasuries and they are giving one to five different counterparties. That's a bilateral trade probably till the end of time. But creating a basket and blending is definitely a move to Tri-Party. And many of these firms, remember, on the buy side, they have grown up over the last 5 years allocating their IM on that platform, whether it's ours or somebody else's, and they understand how it works. They understand the value.
So while UMR drove a shift towards cash as VM, it's also driven a familiarization with the buy side on how the Tri-Party platform works. And we all know there's the operational efficiencies that you've just described, which will mitigate some of that settlement risk. And that makes a lot of sense to the buy side. What makes it attractive to the front office and treasury? And what problems can it solve there?
Well, if we look at this, yeah, from a sell side perspective. So buy side is evident, sell side. And Alan's talked about it before, but the onward use of the assets are really imperative. So the most logical step one we see in the conversation is, can I receive from my clients variation on Tri-Party? And I must have an onward use case. I cannot just sit on the asset. Yes, VM coming in logically goes out as VM, but also as initial margin. So matching on the derivative portfolio on the CSA for VM and the CSA or CSD for IM becomes a first step. There are obvious conversations and other outlets going into the repo desk. I think some of the collateral that will be coming in from the buy side has an intrinsic additional value for financing. So when they're connecting up in the big bank infrastructure, they have to be open-minded. It's not just a derivative play, but the most obvious one will be VMI ML.
Yeah. And Alan, we spoke about documentation earlier. How does Triparty change for the documentation challenges, isn't it?
Well, the first thing one would want to do when looking at the VM is checking those reuse cases. So you would want to make sure that you had aligned your VM to your IM or repo use cases to make sure that you can reuse the asset. Now, Mark touched on it earlier. In terms of the waterfall, my preference for reusing this collateral would be in VM because that helps me mitigate some of the cold VA PV. In cases where I cannot do that, I will utilize it probably initially in UMR IM and then in the broader repo market. But having that correct documentation to make sure that you've got consistent eligibility across your docs and the operational certainty that once received can be reused is going to be key to getting sell-side firms comfortable to adopt.
I think what I have picked up again, back to my research, is that many of the sell-side firms, they built in to the infrastructure of Triparty agents for IM, but they have not built in for the VM. And that's their challenge, which I believe many of them are dealing with in 2026 and into 27. Of course, the ability to reuse collateral has been available at BNY's Triparty for a number of years. Reversing in on a repo and then allocating onward on a repo transaction, well, that's been available for a very long time. So from a BNY technical capability, it's done. I think it's getting the internal pipework connected up of our clients is where the challenge sits today.
So Triparty can solve some of the operational challenges and also deliver those front office benefits. But coming back to the business case, how can firms measure the success of this if they do proceed?
I think from a sell side perspective, it's going to be a combination of revenue for providing liquidity, the reuse of the collateral to see you do not have significant incremental jumps in your NSFR or RWAs, and also client take up. This is something their clients need. I think from the buy side, it's going to be more difficult. I think buy sides know they need this liquidity in times of stress. The question is, do they need to wait for an event to try and put it in place? And if so, what would that event look like? If not, are they prepared to make the investment now to reuse that collateral and lower their costs and buy the option of that future liquidity?
I think we can safely say, although onboarding and execution times have improved dramatically of the Triparty agents, I wouldn't wait for the event to start the process.
Totally agree with that.
There are other values and measures, Craig, I think, again, keep going with operations. So within my own organization, we provide outsourced collateral administration, middle office of collateral. And one of the key values there in pricing that service is the FTE, the headcount. And my colleagues have said that the headcount is, it can be adjusted down when they have a bilateral settlement versus when they have a Triparty-based settlement, specifically for IM. So if they have a client that moves it into a manual third-party structure versus Triparty, they see a price difference or a cost difference in their manual input. And having worked with them, they expect that equally that would drive their pricing down or it would drive their cost down if they were to see more movement from bilateral. So they already have clients that deliver bilaterally. And they know what that costs. There's an oversight, there's pricing, there's all the various things I've discussed earlier in the recording. If they move to Triparty, they see so much of that going to an automated structure that they are reducing the amount of human beings that are required to oversee, which has a cost impact. Now, that's an internal to BNY thing, but imagine that's now an internalized operational function at X firm.
Yeah,
that should be applied as well. So I think that there is a human time saving, which equals money, that will come from a movement to a Triparty allocated settlement versus a true bilateral settlement.
Yeah, and we often talk about the total cost of operation, which includes, you know, people, tech, data, and increasingly other associated costs, which will include the capital that Alan's spoken about, the settlement fines, all of which Triparty has the potential to improve. So we've spoken about, I guess, the lag between sentiment. What needs to happen to shift and accelerate the adoption? And which segments or products do you think will move first, Mark?
Segments first. I think segments are currently being led by insurance and other asset owners such as pension funds. Those are the two that stand out for me on the buy side. Within that asset class seems to be corporates, a lot of corporate conversation. Again, that's tied very neatly to insurers, fixed income mostly on the pension funds. But equally, we do occasionally hear equities coming up. And I know Alan will tell you that's a more prickly subject in terms of getting the right cost of capital against the equity. But if you're an equity only fund, you're either giving equity or you're giving cash.
Yeah.
And again, I think that you will have niche structures like that.
And Alan, do you think this is something that needs critical mass, i.e. wide adoption across the industry, or could there be a single use case that will start to drive the use between potentially one dealer bank?
I think different benefits case will drive the initial use cases. So I totally agree with Mark. The pension funds who are doing long-dated derivatives and have this liquidity need is going to be the starting point. But as Mark touched on, posting a broader set of collateral and banks having the operational capability to mitigate their costs whilst charging for the liquidity premium of offering that collateral certainly could be something that picks up speed relatively quickly once the operational processes are in place and people become confident that the reuse cases are robust and operationally reliable. On the equities point, equities is a little bit more prickly because there is much more uncertainty over the discounting risk. And the reuse, whilst could be used in UMR, often banks are very long equities on their balance sheet and do not need excess equities from a funding perspective.
Looking a bit further out, we've spoken about Tri-Party and its ability to solve for some of those operational challenges and make this more scalable. How do we think tokenization will play into this?
Tokenization is a hot topic, of course, at the moment, right? So digital this and that. However, what I have picked up in conversation is that many firms see this more of an external market settlement issue, and they're not necessarily running towards a tokenized asset as collateral on a tokenized platform. There are certain uncertainties there, of course, regulatory and legal and reputational. But actually, where's the problem? The problem is mobilizing your assets and moving them around. Once they get to a Tri-Party agent, it's kind of a, dare I say, an analog version of a tokenized future, yep. Which is that you've already got the legal certainty, you've already got the technology, you're plugged and played, you've got the contracts. So I think that tokens and digital this and that, valuable, really valuable, but solving a different problem, which is general market settlement. How do I get my assets to the Tri-Party agent can be solved. Once it's to the Tri-Party agent, in our case, we're moving books and records. So if it's a tokenized treasury or a regular treasury, it doesn't really look any different. It will still behave the same. It will be allocated in a basket of eligible collateral in much the same way. Equally, of course, when it comes to the liquidation, you can liquidate back into a traditional form, which gives you security, or it may be the case that firms will want to off-ramp the tokenized asset, and that's fine. So Tri-Party sits somewhere in the middle, and I think it's a great way of following this evolution that I'm saying about VM. Is in the next 3 to 5 years, use what everybody knows before some other unknown future comes along that potentially could do it even better.
And Alan, do you agree? Are any challenges with tokenized assets in their application to the RWA and SFR?
Well, I think tokenized assets have some issues to be resolved, to be used as variation margin. There's some ambiguity over netting opinions and fungibility with tokenized assets, which would need to be resolved first. However, to add to Mark's point, I see tokenization as becoming additive to this. So once those issues are resolved on a more generic basis, I would see tokenized assets as anything that increases the probability or the velocity of collateral and the probability of an increase in reuse will help this benefits case.
Very good. So watch this space there. So fast forward 12 months, what's the measurable indicator that we think would demonstrate if adoption has increased?
Yeah, of course, there are metrics out there. One of the things that pricked my interest a few years ago was the ISDA annual margin survey published again at their AGM coming up. And I think we'll see a continued change. It was 68% last year. I think we'll get into the low to mid 60s on non-cash allocation versus cash. That's a measure. That's a clear measure. I think we can always revisit and do our own surveys. We did one last year with risk.net and see where the market's got to. Those are two measures. Of course, as a Tri-Party agent, as a platform, I can't publish it, but I will know whether we've actually swung the needle. If my balance goes up and I can define that there is variation margin or more variation margin going through Tri-Party, I will have moved from, as I see it today, a tactical capability, because we have variation margin on the system and it's been there for some years, to a more of a strategic uptake. I won't quote what the number will be, but if I can see that movement, then that's my measure of success.
And I think from a bank perspective, again, it can't be published, but are we seeing increased eligibility to show a broader set of assets being eligible under CSAs? And then it will come out in the margin survey if that eligibility is then being utilized by the buy side.
So before we close, what would be the next steps for firms who think this is an opportunity they'd like to explore to validating the business case for themselves?
I think from a buy-side perspective, you're going to be looking at what assets you have and where you want to utilize them, and what is the potential liquidity cost by having a conversation with your liquidity providers of incorporating these assets in your eligibility schedules. From the bank's perspective, based on that reverse inquiry from the clients, what is the cost in terms of discounting of those changes coming through based on the exposures you have to those clients? And what are the reuse cases to mitigate those costs in your broader set of collateral agreements?
And is there any analysis they should be doing on RWA, NSFR, LCR? And if so, how do they quantify that?
So from an NSFR perspective, receiving more corporate bonds or lower quality level two assets will have an impact. It's going to be a function of their exposure if they were to allow the switching of government bonds to corporate bonds from day one. From an RWA perspective, it will depend on haircuts negotiated and discussed with the credit departments. Fundamentally, it's going to be also, what else are you posting, say, for example, in your UMR, and can you reuse those assets, and what assets become freed up as a result of the reuse of the lower quality assets in your variation margin? So if you are freeing up government bonds, you can mitigate some of that initial NSFR costs.
I guess a point that jumps out to me is, in order to complete that analysis, you need a view of your universe of eligible collateral. And that's where I think bringing in the digital view, leveraging potentially some other technology to scrape your CSAs if you don't already have it.
Absolutely. So you need to think about not just your CSAs, but your ISDAs. So for example, you'd want to know what interest rates you are paying on your ISDAs on your variation margin. You would then want to know what is in your CSAs. Mark picked up on it earlier about at a level of detail around concentration limits, etc. So it's very important you have very granular data per counterparty. You would want to then augment that with your exposure profiles that you are producing for your credit departments to understand how long you are likely to be receiving or posting collateral, because that is going to be key to your pricing. So I think you're going to need to augment this with data from multiple documents, including your ISDA, your UMR, your repo, and your stop borrow loan docs, incorporating all of the eligibility to understand your reuse cases. You're going to need to understand the exposures that you're running and their likelihood of changing over time. And then from there, you can start recalculating your reserves and your capital utilization in the future to really put some detailed and robust figures on that benefits case.
There's quite a lot that goes into that. I think you need a lot of tools from what you're saying there. And this, again, takes me back to my UMR days of 2018, 19. Now, what we found was everybody had to do IM for a mandatory reason. This is more of an optional reason than there are benefits. But actually, many firms realized they couldn't do it on their own. I think this is a similar journey that you're probably going to need to look at this as a buy-sider with, do you have the right technology? Do you have the right consulting? Do you have the right legal? Do you have the right compliance oversight? All of which doesn't necessarily sit in your own organization. And I don't think there's ever a problem with putting a hand up and looking at some external help, specialist help. And then also, I think a lot of this comes down to, again, Alan's raised it, is having a good conversation with your key bank counterparts, because this is a really material impact, potential change to them. You need to embrace it together to get the full benefit out of it together. There's something in it for you both. If you engage in this as almost confrontation of, oh, I have to do this because the client says so, that's not right. If you actually go through this and find that there are positives, there are weaknesses, but overall the positives are stronger, then you're going to win. Buy and sell side have to win on this.
Agreed. I think that's a really important point. UMR was imposed upon people and there was an unprecedented volume, as you and I lived through, Mark, and the focus of firms in that instance was compliance, making sure there was no interruption to trading and what was the path of least resistance. And now this is kind of the next day, as we often spoke about over time. So what's the strategic approach to this now? Right, we're compliant, UMR, you know, the memories of the birth pains have gone. Let's look at it again and how can we be more efficient and do this strategically. So that's a wrap for today's episode. My thanks again to Mark Higgins and Alan Baxter for their insights on why interest is growing in non-cash collateral for variation margin. I think we've discussed and proven that the use case is real for both the buy side and the sell side. There's some effort in order to implement the changes required, but the business case, if proven, which will need to be tailored to individual firm circumstances, can deliver real value, real revenue opportunities for certain firms, and that return on interest is quick. Yeah, many firms can start to realise the cost in less than 12 months based on some of the numbers that we've seen. Next steps, firms should obviously engage their counterparts in conversations, engage their service providers such as Bank of New York or other custodians are available. They can speak to us. We're happy to pick up conversations and share our insights as well. In the meantime, thank you once again.
Thank you very much, Craig.
Thanks, Craig.
That's a wrap.
You've been listening to Tonic Boom. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest developments and industry opinion across capital markets. Visit thetonicconsultancy.com to see more of our expertise-led insights and end-to-end solutions. Tonic. More expertise, more trust, more achieved.